of a few things that we discussed, but we're going to start putting things together. So first thing, one thing we did is, so when we started thinking, okay, let's focus on the propagation. Let's not concern ourselves yet to how, as to how the waveform was produced. So we, again, working at linear order in perturbation theory. So we imagine the metric is flat plus a little bit of a perturbation. On that, we were able to, by picking a specific gauge, the transverse trace-free gauge, we were able to show that the equation of motion for determining the small perturbation on the flat matrix was given by the box of these. And out of that, we could find out that the general solution could be written this way. Or here, this k has to be a null vector, and also has to be orthogonal to the direction. So the effect of a gravitational wave would be orthogonal to the direction of that propagation. So we said, if we just so happen to choose our coordinate systems that such that it happened to be aligned along the direction of propagation, then the solution had to be like so, because our gauge said the time, any time component would be zero. Then along z would also be zero, because you had this thing had to be normal to the direction of propagation. And then we all only were left out with this, where we had trace free due to, well, our gauge. And then we also had that thing that was free, and then we had to find out what it was. Then we started saying, okay, how can we make contact with the generation itself? And so we chose a different gauge. In that gauge, and then notice that this is adapted kind of along the propagation. So we're kind of riding along the direction of propagation, which is a null vector. When we try and do this, we actually looked at very close to the source, and we connected with Newtonian concepts. So in some sense here, we're thinking, well, we have a little bit of a space, kind of space-time description that is very similar to what we would have done in Newtonian. There is some time associated here, and we're looking at what happens in the sources. But by many assumptions, we were able to link that to the second time derivative of this quadrupole tensor. And this is the second time derivative here of the source, but evaluated with respect to what the observer will see along the retarded time. So here's where we go back to, if we have an observer somewhere here, the observer is actually seen into the past till it makes contact with the region where the source is. The variations are happening here, and it's registered later to the observer by this kind of retarded time. So if we are somehow at a distance r, this is very delicate to measure or to kind of make sense in general relativity. But in the weak field regime that we're thinking about, we're assuming that we have some distance away with the source. The propagation takes place along a null trajectory. So you could imagine that, okay, this is a line at 45 degrees, and okay, this is where you're sitting with your detector when the system is doing, maybe going around this way. We try and make some connection with a very simple setup. This is a binary system, so we imagine the very idealized scenario where we have two objects that have the same mass. They happen to be at the distance, say, 2r. And then by using that expression, one derives kind of this expression where we make very evident that we have this field that decays in strength as 1 over r from the source, but assume the source was localized. We picked up here a frequency square dependence that comes from the acceleration of the quadrupole. So again, if we have a quadrupole that is stationary, we have no gravitational waves associated or generated by that. And here we have kind of the plus and cross, but we're going to discuss that next, seating. So this is the trace-free component, but along kind of in the same direction of each vector. And this will become clear in a second. And then we have, here, missing a minus sign. And notice that the argument has two things. As first, twice the orbital frequency, and that we argue was a natural thing to expect, because as far as any perturbation that this object makes, say, along that direction, when it goes around and the second object comes to the same place, we would see that. Of course, if this was kind of mass ratio of this symmetry were not in the problem, this would be representing what the functional dependence is. And notice that the argument has tr, it's not t. So it has to be evaluated with respect to what the source is doing at a retarded time with respect to the observer. So when you see gravitational waves, it happened, you're seeing what happened a long time ago, depending on how far the source is. So now let's try and make, yes.
When we were doing ENM, we had like traceless quadrupoles, but here we define
okay, so the traceless quadrupole, it depends, so I'm not sure what you're referring to, but we're going to make contact with a traceless quadrupole of the source when we try and make connection with the energy that the source is producing and how it's radiating. So as far as the details of the waveforms themselves come with the quadrupole or the acceleration of the quadrupole, when we talk about energy, it will come with respect to the trace-free quadrupole, which is just a relation, a trivial relation with this.
Okay, so we can define the trace-free one.
Okay. Yeah, we can, and we will define it, and it will be key when we write what the energy of the system, what the energy loss of the system is, which will be related. I mean, I'm just kind of getting ahead of myself. The energy will be related to the third time derivative of the trace-free quadrupole. Okay, so but before getting there, let's go back to this plus and cross business. So why is it that we called it that way? And why is it LIGO, as I mentioned, is designed the way it is? Suppose, again, we are going at our geodesics. Imagine that we have tangent fields across all these geodesics. We imagine kind of pervaded space-time, at least in the region around where we're going to measure things. We have a vector that is orthogonal to it, and we derive the geodesic deviation equation that basically said the second derivative of that vector with respect to the proper time. It's given by R mu rho sigma. So that was our general expression. And when we discuss it, we notice, oh, this is how we know that everything we were building with respect to our manifolds and how we're going to interpret the curvature is kind of being very evident here. So it tells us that geodesics can go, nearby geodesics can go close or farther to each other just because of the presence of some curvature in the space in the manifold we're working with. And now we're just going to make it simplified, think for specifically about the case of interest, which is we're very far out. We can rely on the metric tensors that we have written, or the perturbations. We're going to assume UA happens to be an observer, which is at rest. We're now going to make the observer move around with respect to the next geodesic. So we can say UA, and I'm going to say it's 1, 0. And I don't have to add anything else because we're very far out. And any contribution of the normalization that we want from this vector, which will have an h, will be subleading with respect to what we're trying to compute. So that we can assume. Another one is at the level we're working, which is a linear level, tau. It's the same thing as whatever coordinate is this object is carrying, which is x0, which is what we're going to call t. So then this thing simply becomes the second derivative of s with respect to tau twice. Now, because of what we assume there, and let's say we only care, well, let's just keep it general for the time being. But because these components have lots of zeros, the only thing we need to worry about is, let me lower the, let me lower the index for a second. All right, so we only need this because of this series over there. And now let's use our expression for the Riemann tensor. We're just going to stick to the same level of approximation, the same gauge, and everything that we use to obtain this. So this is what? Just make sure it's quite nice wrong here.
Why was UA equal to 1 and 0 again?
So this is our observer, this is us. And so we're just stationary. And so we don't add any motion on that gelatin. The simplest one.
But for example, for an observer in a Schwarzschild metric, didn't we use UA is equal to U0 and other components being 0, and then we derived U0 from the normalization condition?
Yes, but we were having, at that point, we had a different goal. So there, we're trying to obtain kind of something near the GDS, near the black hole Schwarzschild. Here, you're absolutely as far as you need to be from the source. So again, you could go back to what we did in Schwarzschild and take the limit of R going to very large. So then you're going to have corrections in this. So there are corrections. But we're working to linear order in our metric thing. So here will be corrections that are proportional to H. But notice what would happen here. We have R times things, and the R has the H. And so then at that level, we just need to focus only on the leading part. So now we recall what we had for our transverseless trace gauge, and any zero something was zero. So this doesn't contribute, and same thing here. So then we have 1/2. S sigma, second derivative with respect to t twice. So to linear order in the transverseless trace gauge that we're working with, what we just have is that the geodesic deviation tells us that the vector that is orthogonal to our observer varies as a wave goes by in this way. So it responds to the second time derivative of the wave times the vector orthogonal to it. This will change. That will be the acceleration that we would measure. And again, so what LIO has is at the end, I'm going to do this. At the end of each path, as mirror that is suspended, the light goes that way, And what you're measuring is how this thing moves, how it accelerates relative to this R1. So in some sense, it's in free fall in this direction.
Could you say that again?
Say again?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
It's in free fall. So that doesn't feel any forces in this direction. So you're hanging in this where you have a pendulum. You have a mirror here attached. And so it can, if a wave goes through, it can make it move in this direction. But you're hanging it from this R1. So you don't register this kind of force. So this is what an interferometer like LIGO, Virgo, Agra. So these are the kind of three detectors that are kind of functioning right now. There's two in the US, one in Italy, one in Japan. This one is coming kind of later to the game, so it's still barely useful from the point of view of how far it can really see. But it's catching up very quickly. So soon all of these guys will be operational. In the past, it was a different object or the different technology that people were using. It was just to have a bar, a really big bar. As a wave goes through, the idea was that it will excite some modes, some normal modes of the bar, and then you were trying to measure those. This squeezes thing a little bit, then it will, the idea was that it could excite particular frequencies of these bars, and then the idea was to measure that frequency. They were pretty good, but the sensitivity was not as great as this one. So this was the technology, the main technologies up to the mid 90s, and it got replaced by that one. Because later on, next decade, this should be operational. This LISA, it goes to space, so just to give you a sense of scale. The arms of these guys are kilometer scales, so 4, 3, and I can't remember, Kagra is probably that same argument, the same scale, but it's kilometer scale, this one. This one is a million kilometers scale. You put it in space, but it's a similar concept. You have a central, actually you have three satellites that they are sending lasers, and they're comparing the time of arrivals of the lasers. Of course, when you send here, you send a pulse. When you're observing that pulse a million kilometers away, you get a few photons, despite dispersion. What else would you say? Okay, let's leave it there, then we'll come back. So now, let's go to our, yes?
How does length of arm appears in the equation that we have? Like, how does it change the accuracy?
It changes in the sensitivity. So the signal to noise that you have, because this is H, so what it actually will, and then you're measuring relative changes. You're measuring delta L over L. So if you have a much longer L, then you can achieve a similar precision, because H is roughly this. So the longer L is, the easier it is to get better sensitivity. Of course, the challenge is to make it happen. So here, you want to ensure that nothing else kind of can be blame on any particular perturbation or change. So on Earth, these are vacuum. And so this is the largest vacuum system. So look at this level at that time, so 4 kilometers, so that was LIGO. In space, okay, you get sort of vacuum for free, but okay, there is still some non-trivial density. This is why you have to, the technology has to catch up. And so this is a project that was supposed to fly. The joke was it was always 5 years in the future, no matter when you talked about it. But a few years ago, there was a Pathfinder mission that tested the technology, and it worked well. And cross fingers, all is set for a launch at the end of next 2034, thereabouts. Actually, now I have to think. Well, it was this decade, 2029, but I think it got, the COVID has kind of pushed things to later time. So in the time scale of 10 years, this thing should be up. And I should say there's two more Chinese like this, Tianjiang is one, and they are kind of pronounced. I already mispronounced that one, and I cannot even pronounce the other one. There are two other projects from China, similar in the sense that they are space-based.
Are they supposed to launch sooner or later?
They're competing. So their time scale is extremely aggressive, in the best possible sense. So they're aggressive in the sense that coming from zero development in this field. So like if you compare this one, so LISA is building on a lot of things that are known, that were learned from, especially Virgo. LISA is a European Space Agency led experiment. So China is coming from scratch. And this same thing happened with Japan with Kagura, is why they are kind of behind, but they are moving really fast. So it's amazing how they went from zero to having a detector in a very short number of years, and same here. But it's interesting to think about the socio-political issues related with two projects that are massive in China research. Both of them will go through, likely only one, but they're gone.
Can I ask another
question? Yeah, I can do.
On the order of 10 million kilometers, where are they going to be orbiting the sun? Or
so they're going to be, so again, depending on the project, but let's say the LISA will be coming behind us on Earth, and then just some at the same time also rotating.
Lagrange point again? Or?
I can't remember, but I don't think so. I don't know. It's, but it comes close by and following an Earth. These are ones are slightly different. I can't remember the details. But yeah, so you're talking about these scales are complicated.
Again, given this question, like,
yes,
these detectors, they're going to observe any perturbation in the metric, right? Like that edge could, we can produce that edge, like lots of sources at the same time, they can produce that edge. How do we, like, how?
Yeah, we had that question. Can you hold on to that question? We're going to get to that at the end. So someone asked, I think he asked that question at the end of last class, but we're going to go and say discuss a little bit about the gravitational waves, and please bring that question again. But you're right, so that's a concern.
A very basic question, but the UA equals 1, 0. I'm just trying to get it straight that T is the time of the observer.
T is the time of the observer, yes.
Okay, so then that's always true, even if we don't make an approximation.
Yeah, but here we have tau.
What is tau? Tau is the time.
Tau is the proper time along the geodesic. And then we said that, let's say that's the one that has an affine parameterization. And we're saying, suppose you have laid down a coordinate Tx, which are associated with your flat space-time coordinates, that were eta happen to be -1, 1, 1, 1. So we're adapting the same one. So even though there should be a little bit of a correction, because it's a geodesic and we have some small curvature, nevertheless, that comes at a higher order. And so we can make, we can say that time, the TEX coordinate system here, this label is also the affine label of the geodesic at this order that we're working. Okay, so now what we can do is just take this equation, use this solution, and just try and solve it. So let's say, first, let's imagine I'm going to define this. This for that, for the moment is a definition. Right. Just let's label it this way. And for the sake of the argument, because they are independent, 1, 1, and 1, 2, imagine that C1, 2 is equal to 0. We're working with a linear equation, so we might as well just solve independently 1 and the R1. So we do that. Let's say it's mu. Well, let me just put a 1 here. But if we're interested in the component 1, then this is the equation we have. Because remember, we're working now with the C1, 2 set to 0. So we have a diagonal. So S1 is influenced by itself. S2 is influenced by itself.
Wait, can you tell us again why it's OK to solve them independently?
So we're dealing with a linear equation. So we can imagine that the final solution is a superposition of the two ones that we solve. So we assume that we only have this one first and this one second. And the reason we're going to do that is just to try and understand the influence of both separately. So what did I do? Again, so I pick the one here. This gives me the one over there. And then sigma will have to be whatever we have. And we can have one or two. But 2 doesn't show up because of this assumption, 1, 2 is equal to 0. So then what we see is that their acceleration along the direction which we call one is given by the second time derivatives of our source, the wave, multiplied by S1. So we have to solve this equation. And again, we can work hard. We can work hard to try and get it, or we can just say, let's postulate the simple ansatz and realize that we're trying to do this only at the level of the approximation we're carrying, which is first order in H. So if you do that, and of course, let me put a comma here that I said this. That if we think of component number two under the same assumption, then component number two follows the same equation with the two there. And the solution for either component one or component two under this assumption is 1 plus minus
minus come from the plus minus h, right? When you put the comma to, it should be.
That's right. Yeah. So the one comes, the plus one is because we're talking about that one, and the minus one is because this is the one that comes, the second component. So.
Then the h.
Hold on.
Plus h plus or h.
Hold on. So let me just. So this is two here. Is it clear? The minus sign there. So if I talk about component one, is 1 plus h plus s1 at the initial time, whatever our initial time is. And we'll talk about component 2 is 1 minus this
component 2. Is it still h plus or is it h cross?
H plus. H cross is 0.
Oh, okay.
So here is a, if we only look for a solution for s1, then we have 1 plus, again, and it comes from here. The component of the metric that comes in is C11. When we talk about number two, it gives us the minus sign. So this is the one that comes in. Yes?
So the differentiation there is with respect to
time.
These components depend.
Hold on. Okay, good. But careful, let's not mix things up. So here, so remember, we have two different gate choices. We're working here. Don't look over there. That was when we tried to relate what the source was doing with what the wave that is produced. But when you try and do this, because of the complications of solving the problem, you usually have something that closes the source. You analyze what's going on there, and you imagine the waves are going out, and then you hand out the description to a picture like this.
What's exponential of iota
kcx? So this is our wave solution. Our wave solution was cab, right, times e to the ik, where k is a vector. And if we're assuming there is a propagation along the z direction, and k has to be null, so then k is where w was the frequency of the wave.
And xc is the coordinate of the observer?
Xc is the coordinates that we lay down in general. And because we're solving this again, this to first order, our coordinates tx. Good. So here is where we see that if we have any vector, imagine s1 has a vector along 1 and 2, direction 1 and direction 2. As the wave passes, let's say we take any arbitrary time, we see this one. Let's imagine that this contribution is positive, it has an even sign. It stretches in that direction. See, this will make larger this way, but this one will compress it. But this is oscillating in time. So then after a period or half a period, then we'll go to 0, recover the same height, the same length. And then the opposite would happen. So this is why this mode or this polarization, one that is represented this way, so it's called the plus polarization. So this one stretches in one direction, compresses in the R1, the thing oscillates in doing this kind of deformation to a ring of particles.
The what polarization?
Glass.
Glass.
The story goes that Will Press came up with that because he kind of got tired of people talking this polarization, that polarization, and people say, well, that's plus and cross, let's call it that way, and then people pick that name up. So now, let's look at the second component. So it's essentially the same. We just now think of C11 is equal to 0, so H plus 0. Let's consider C12 is different from 0, so H cross is different from 0. We do that, and the thing that is going to change, now because the metric is off diagonal, we see two things will happen. We're not going to pick up the minus sign, as you asked, because then the components have the same sign. But the dependence of the problem are kind of switch. Here we have 1 and 2. We're going to see 2 and 1. Or if you want that equation up there, 1 and 2, we're going to have S21. And the solution in this case will be I forgot I had in mind a factor of 2 here that was missing.
Sorry about that.
So this is the one you see that whatever it had, now the change will be affecting the other way. So this Y, this one is called the cross because it will kind of. If you have, let's say this, I'm going to do it this way. So will the change in 1 will be related to what 2, the value of 2 is. And so then they will say, OK, make this one shorter, make one that longer, and then this cycle continues. So the ring of particles will be deformed this way, go back to this one that way. And so it is for this kind of description that the plus and cross terminology came up. Was brought in. Yes?
In terms of the H plus will separate my geodesic and it will stretch it in perpendicular directions. But
So imagine now you have a whole bunch of geodesics. Imagine if this is when I draw these. I'm looking at that geodesics, but the geodesics are coming out this way. So time for us is going this way. And so you have geodesics all here. All right. And you're asking, as the wave goes also in this direction, what does it do? So we know the wave is transverse. And if we only have H plus, as time goes by, it will, and let's call it this way, this is H plus. H cross, it will deform it this way, but it's oscillating, so then it will go through the circular shape again, then it will do the opposite, circular shape again. And if you have something that only has the cross polarization under the same assumptions, it will deform it at 45 degrees back to the circle, 45 degrees opposite back to the circle, and this thing goes. Of course, in reality, what you have is the combination of both. And depending on the projection of to your detector, because there is, so the detector could be aligned this way, aligned that way, whatever, you're going to have more sensitivity to one the R1 or both. So there's a combination of the propagation direction of the waveform, the relation with the source, what the source was doing. So if you have, imagine that case, the two that are doing this way with respect to you, or are doing that way with respect to you. So the polarizations will change. So it depends on the source, the direction from source to observer, and geometry of your detector. All that has to be taken into account.
Can you explain again why the vector S is related to the actual physical length?
Of the vector S is related to?
S is related to actual physical length.
Yes, it's related to the physical length. So if you want, you could imagine there is a, let's think of it this way, there is a geodesic just sitting in the middle here. And then this S is a vector that goes from that geodesic to the this nearby geodesic. And so then this is, if you want, that's it, that's our length. And as the time, as the wave goes by, this length will change differently along the different directions. And the plus and cross are just telling you essentially how it, if you think of the collection of particles, the net effect is to deform these ones in this way and this one in that way, if you have plus and cross. Of course, you would say, well, now connected to several of the questions, if I want to maximize my sensitivity, I would be better served making a very, very large, as large a nest as I can. So if I have a small effect here, I have a much more detectable effect if it's over there. But you have to be careful because the waveform comes with its own wavelength. And so you want to maximize the effect that, so it's pushing not everything uniformly. So they're along this line. So this point may be pushed this way, this point may be pushed that way because of the wavelength that there might be in it. So this is why detectors, and we'll discuss something in a little bit, detectors typically target some mass ranges where the wavelengths are naturally, the wavelengths and wave frequencies are naturally adapted to measuring those kind of sources as opposed to the other ones. So LIGO, for instance, see black holes, can see black holes of masses 1 to 100, but it has no business seeing black holes of millions or masses. Can't do it. Frequency is just too low. And the wavelength is so large that these particles or these geodesics barely sense any move.
Is the polarization dependent on some characteristic source there? Like,
yes.
How would you have a single polarization?
It would be very difficult, but you could. So this is what we're saying. So depending on what the source is doing, even if the source is asymmetric as you can make it, like two objects, same mass, I can have them, if you're the observer, if the system is going this way or going that way, you're going to have so this one would be like linearly polarized, this one would look like circularly polarized, but any of those polarizations can be represented as a superposition, appropriate superposition of this H plus and H cross. So that will be part of the problem. Now this source is away from you and you have your detector, and where you have your detector, if your detector is this way, that way, or any particular configuration, then you're going to be more sensitive or less sensitive to particular polarization.
What do we solve for the frequency, the zeroth component of K?
The frequency, so here, you're going to see the frequency had to do with the frequency of the gravitational waves. So now the way this oscillates is related to the way that thing oscillates, which is related to this frequency, right, which is related to that frequency. So there's a connection between source. The source tells you some frequency. In this particular very simple scenario that we discuss here, we have the wrong assumption, but it's the working assumption, at least for some time, that this orbits with a given frequency that it is the input, doesn't change. Then when we computed the waveforms, the solutions have a frequency that is twice. Okay, that's the one, so like the cosine 2 omega tr is the same thing discussed in this form as e to the I kc, because there will be the time component omega time, and then there is a rumor in the tr, there is both space and time. And that's the one that will cause this ring of particles to oscillate. So it sets the oscillation in relation to the frequency that the wave has, which is produced by the source.
Can we just compute the proper distance between two space-like separating points and claim that if there's a perturbation, plus polarization changes?
Yeah, and that's what you're doing. And remember, in some sense, these things, so what would be the proper distance? Would be take a time equal constant, and then you say along this direction, it's, let's say hxx dx squared. Sorry, not gx, gxx. But it's along just dx. And so here you're saying it's eta x plus hxx. Right. And so this is what you're doing. You're computing the, and that's the s. So this is measuring how stretch or compress your natural distances. Because in reality, you don't do that. Easier for technical reasons. But I don't quite know. So rather than measuring this distance, is to then measure the frequency of oscillation of your mirrors, the frequency of oscillation of your bar. So depends. That goes into the technical challenge of how you make this happen. So now let's try quickly to make one more connection, which we have yet to do. So I mentioned in passing just a minute ago that we had a very idealized scenario. We said the objects are orbiting at a given frequency. Nowhere, anywhere, had we said, oh, but these things have to be getting closer and closer and eventually merge. So how does that happen? That happens because you're losing energy. As you're losing energy from your system, then the orbits get tighter and tighter. They go deeper and deeper in the potential well. They accelerate even further, and then you have the merger. But so what we need to now at least discuss a little bit to some level is to have a way or a means to compute or establish that gravitational waves carry energy away from the system, which we have yet to do. This is what I'm trying to do now.
How did you exactly solve that equation? Because you assume that if you plug that in, that works, but how would you know that that's the unique solution to that equation? Because your S1, comma 2 is outside the d squared dt squared.
Right.
So I would imagine there would be much more complicated solutions to that equation as well.
No, so you could solve it in general, or you can solve it perturbatively. And the leading order contribution is this one. So we just solve it perturbatively.
In what? The perturbation is done in what?
In, so H and S. So we have at most that's our small parameter. So we don't want S squared H. We don't want S H squared. So this is the leading. And if you plug this in there, you're going to realize that it satisfies it, but leaves some things but which are higher order. So this plug in there doesn't give you an exact identity. Gives you that. So it satisfies that plus some crap, but that crap is a square. Okay, so let me just, we're not going to go into much detail here because the full computations are very messy to be done even in class or in the homework problem. But let's just picture what we're trying to do. We're trying to say the energy, say, of this system is such that it gets lost, at least some of it, by gravitational radiation. So how do we make contact with that? So in analogy, we work with analogy with electromagnetism or kind of a scalar field. We notice that when we wrote a stress energy tensor, TAB, out of this TAB, we can make sense of some energy, which let's say we're keeping the simplest possible coordinate system, where it is TX and our observer is it's the same observer over there, the 1, 0, right? So E is somehow seated here in the T00 component, then we have a momenta, let's call it this, which is T0i, and the this equation, dA TAB equals 0, if we pick the B equals 0 component, this is dA TA 0, which we can turn as dT T00 plus dI TI 0 equals 0, and if I write this in terms of kind of these bookkeeping variables that in some sense in the right regime makes perfect sense. What we have here is the following. So an equation that says energy will change as flux of energy will go in or out of the system. But if we work or we think about what we know from electromagnetism and the scalar field, TAB, we remember that TAB is quadratic in our fields. So if we had, we're talking about the scalar field, TAB was dA phi, dB phi, and then quadratic things. And similarly with electromagnetism, E squared and B squared showing up. When we discuss, we've been working at linear order in the H. So we have established all through the course that our field is the gravitational field. We were discussing the gravitational field here up as a perturbation of flat spacetime. We carry everything only to linear order in H. So if we try and recover at least something that makes sense in analogy with electromagnetism, we can't, because we haven't given us ourselves that chance. We haven't carried out things to second order in the fields. Is that clear? So now we have to bite that bullet. But careful. If we have, we're thinking that the metric G is flat plus H. This was our linear field, but we might have to carry out up to, say, H2. I'm going to only bother putting a 2 to the second order correction of the metric. And if I don't have it, we're going to keep referring to what we have so far written as H. Is that clear? So now imagine sticking this into the Einstein's equation. When you put that, I'm going to put H plus H2. So we're going to proceed very schematically. You can choose to say only work to zeroth order. We know this satisfies Einstein's equation, flat metric, and that satisfies it with no source. We have worked really hard to do or work out what happens when we put H. And we have obtained all these solutions such that these things satisfy Einstein's equation with, say, zero, and when we're thinking about wave propagation, right? So we work that way, and we ended up with an equation that essentially has GAB, and I'm going to denote with a 1 there. So it's a linearized approximation of our Einstein equation, but only dependent on H equal to 0. That was fine. And this is how we obtain the solution. But now we're saying we want to carry this to second order. To second order, we have to be very careful, because at second order, we can have bona fide things that will be dependent on H2. But we also have H squared.
Wait, to be really fine, it was 0?
Yes. We actually used that. So when we made the connection here, we did not use a 0. We had a source, which was the source of this, say, the matter and what the matter was doing. But when we were looking at propagation, we said we solve it with 0. So our frame of mind now is, OK, something is going on with the source. Some waves are propagating. And we're trying to see what happens in between. So we provide some energy. Some waveforms are coming out of some internal region. They are going out. Are we losing energy this way? So what we have to do is to come back here and work to second order into the equations, which will demand us, we are careful, we keep track of the H2s, but also of the H squared. Is that clear?
Wait, no, what's the difference between H2 and H squared?
Good. If I think of the metric, so I'm perturbing the metric of flat spacetime. To leading order, I can have an H.
Yeah.
But to next to leading order, I can have an H2. That's what I label 2.
Would it not just be H squared?
What I mean is it's by labeling. So if you want, let me not call it H. If you want, I can call it H. I don't know, P. P could work. Imagine P. P is the second order. It accounts for the difference between, so let's say, eta plus H, and the true G to leading order is given by P. So if I want to work out to second order in the kind of deviation from purely flat spacetime, I have to keep track of this P. But when I plug it into Einstein's equation, at that order, I will have things that have this P right? Because it's second order. But it will also have h squared, which are these guys squared.
So you don't let the h squared go to zero?
No. But now I can't. In everything we've been working with before, we were setting it to zero. Now we have to work with it. So if you put this in here and work to that order or at that order, so this one, so we had GAB 0 of 8, eta is equal to 0, that's for its flat space then. We put h to linear order, that's 0. That allows us to form, to solve what the h is. When we go to the next order, we're going to have to be careful.
But doesn't that second order correction come from the dot direction of the first order correction? So it should be like some sort of square or like.
Say that again. So this.
Like, doesn't the fact that you have second order correction, like, doesn't the second order correction come from this, like, the back reaction of the.
Yes. And so, right. And the, but it will have its own source. So when you work this out, what you have is the following GAB2, let me put that 2. Of P, remember we're using P as a second order, as a source, and this is what precisely what you're saying, GAB. So let me just call it some source, I'm going to call it this way, S for now, of H square. Right, so the back reaction of this H is acting as a source for the H2, and that's our equation.
Is this S? That's not that S.
No, in reality, what it is whatever is in the right-hand side of what you determine is the contribution or the expression of Einstein's equations that are given by that correcting contribution P. This becomes your source. So if very soon, we're going to call it something else. Let me call it T. And if I put indices, I'll do that. So H itself, that is carrying something that we still need to find out its energy, has a non-trivial back reaction in the space-time, which will force things to curve and determine the equation of P. So that's what it is. So let's see. We're going there because you had a question on this, and then go around. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
What is the expansion parameter of the metric?
So if you want to think of this way, to keep track of things, put an epsilon here. Put a p here. Right? Imagine that's small, and this is order square, second order, and first order.
What is epsilon physically?
Oh, we're gonna then will depend on the scenario. It would, if you want, you can make a length scale associated to the curvature, and then you use that. But yeah, so and then if you want to keep track of things, you work out the first order in epsilon or second order in epsilon, of course, and because we have, for instance, gamma times gamma, so this piece will give me an epsilon h, this piece will give me an epsilon h, which will be an epsilon square h square, which will be end up, which will end up here.
Okay, so h is still fixed at first order by the previous equation. It's now that we're introducing this p that will ultimately also depend on h as a sort of back reaction to.
That's right.
Whose dynamics will fix at second order.
That's right. Yes?
It's not clear to me why the second order correction depends only on h squared and not the source. We are considering nonlinear effects of the Einstein equation.
We're in vacuum. So we're in vacuum. So this is, we're here. We're only working. I mean, but your question is perfectly right. And it's a mess to try and answer. Even this thing is slightly not defined correctly. It only makes reasonable sense when iterated over the space-time. And so this is something we need to take with very much care. In fact, the diffeomorphism invariants that we have to be careful because this TAB, I mean, there's no unique TAB. So if you want, the physical interpretation of this thing is precisely that. It's a source that deviation from fast space-time produces and affects on itself. Because we're carrying things out in the perturbative expansion, the only thing that matters for P is not what P is doing, but what H is doing, which will come through H squared as a source. However, you can write several of these guys that are consistent. So there's not a unique prescription. But in the regime that we're approximating, you can interpret this as a stress energy tensor that the gravitational wave itself produces in the space-time.
We need to go to second order because the first order perturbation, propagation of the first order perturbation doesn't carry out energy from the system.
No, it does carry. In fact, this is what we're going to say now. But we were not allowing its back reaction to act. It never affected things. It was like a field, like electromagnetic field propagating on flat space-time, never affecting what the space-time itself is doing. So this, we had a background that was eta, and we have this field living on top of it. But we remember our gravity discussions. Gravity itself modifies the space-time, so we need to take that into account. So we go to second order, and this is why it comes this way.
So the energy that second order carry out is comparable to the first order. That's why we need to take it into account. Or?
The energy that once we see how it back reacts, it back reacts with the square of itself. And the tensor that will keep up, that will keep track of that, is the solution to this equation, which we're calling P, and will come in here.
The energy momentum tensor, the back reaction would be this thing, right?
Yes, but I was careful with over. Not over-interpreting, but giving it more weight than it has, because this is not unique. It's not free of ambiguities, and those ambiguities don't matter when you consider interrels under your space-time. But if you ask me, even if you're in flat space-time and you say, what's the density of this chalk? I mean, even if up to this level, if you say, what's the density of this chalk? I can tell you what it is. If you say, okay, I have a waveform that goes by, what's the density of that waveform? What's the energy density? We have to be careful. It's not quite correct. The temptation would be to say, oh, it's T00 of this H square. You can show that you can add other pieces to this TAB, which will make everything work out the same way and slightly change it. So this thing has more than one definition.
I was wondering why we can't. Physical meaning, but why can't we add like a T prime of P to that equation? To say,
well, in some sense that T
tensor equivalent of,
well, in some sense that T prime of P is sitting here.
Hmm.
So it's the role of P is in itself on the GAB tensor that you have. The other piece is here.
Why can't we have, why can't all the energy momentum tensor contributions of P be absorbed into the Einstein tensor?
You could do that, but then once you do that, you're solving the full Einstein equations and you're solving GAB of G equal to zero. So that's what you're going after. Here is you're trying to come up with a bookkeeping kind of algorithm that lets you keep track of what you're solving at every given step. So this is a way, and again, this is kind of a manifestation that the way a given gravitational wave is carrying energy is through its square.
We are in vacuum, so we are assuming that energy momentum tensor is zero. This is not exactly nonlinear effect, but we are just separating x square and b, right? So maybe we can write GAB of x square on our edges, or
GAB of what? Of H square? Well, that's in a sense what you're doing, but you have to be careful. Once you plug in here and you follow through the calculation, you end up with lots of contribution. So then you find out that there's something that makes sense as an Einstein tensor on P, and then everything else happens to be a symmetric tensor. That now looking at that equation and kind of working an analogy, you said I can identify that at least to some regime in a loose manner with the stress energy tensor that sources might be.
I kind of had a feeling that you want to calculate this TABH squared, right?
But I will not.
You don't want to?
I mean, we do, and that's what we're going to use next.
Yeah, and so if you want to do that, I mean, why not say, why would it hinder the process if we just add it
at T prime AB of P, and then also calculated that.
But what I'm telling you, this is here. That it's already here. That's the definition of the GAB. Think, work in analogy with the Einstein equation. They said, where did the energy of G goes? Well, it's in the Einstein tensor. When we wrote the Einstein equations in vacuum, which you can have Schwarzschild, I mean, a very complicated thing, it's all in here, all that curvature. So the contribution of the given order on itself is sitting in the left-hand side. And then everything else that you could consider sources is sitting in the right-hand side. In this bookkeeping, of course, in here, everything is slammed into care. Yeah, but excellent questions. I mean, all this, I mean, is, as I said, it's many of these things feel and are unsatisfying. You can make sense asymptotically with further structure, which we're not. It's outside the scope of this course. But just to a large degree, it can be done, but it's still not everything is, as I said, we still don't have a definition of what is the mass of the shock in general. So long story short, let me just give you the punchlines, because I think, that was the main thing. So what we use next is to come back here. So if you come back here, you say, well, given a something that you call the stress energy tensor, assuming it's sensible, the zero zero component would be your energy. The zero I component would be your flux of energy, momentum. And you have this law. So you could imagine integrating this with respect to dt and with respect to d3x. So out of these, so if I define really the energy as in a given sheet at a given time, the total energy in that domain would be, if you want and think about the simplest possible case of some fluid that is at rest, this would be the density integrated over the volume. That's your energy. And then the momenta, you're going to do the same thing this way. So imagine this. So when you integrate this, let me call it T00 again, TCI0. So when I integrate with dt, this gives me the integral of T00 in the volume at, say, T2 and T1. So this is delta E, the change in energy with respect to one slice and a later slice is what is in the left-hand side. The conservation of the volume integral of the density, or the rate of change, or the change of the total energy at a given time minus a different time, that's what you have in the left-hand side. In the right-hand side, you have the integral, let me put it this way, the integral d3x dt of di ti0. So now we can use the divergence theorem, and we'll discuss a little bit more about integrals next class. So this turns into the integral over the surface of the volume you're considering of ti dotted with the normal to the surface. Now integrate over time.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. So
yes.
You said the delta E is equal to, okay, so you said it's equal to the integral of T00, D3x, blah, blah, blah. But then is that an equal sign to the other one as well?
Which one, sorry?
With both terms in the box.
This one?
Yeah, so is that equivalent?
Well, no, because before I had said this goes like the energy, but I hadn't taken into account the integral over the volume.
Yeah.
So that was the energy density, and the other one is momentum density. So now integrating, so take that away. So that equation gives you that.
Why does that also give you the momentum density bit too?
Hold on. So here, then I can integrate this piece, mm-hmm. gives me the energy. Now, when I look at this piece, so it's the integral of this and the integral of that. Mm-hmm. When I look at the integral of this, I realize, oh, this is what I have, but I have a divergence.
Divergence.
Yeah, because it's this di, ti, zero. So I separate this in time component and I component.
Why does that make it diverge?
So it's di of ti, zero. Mm-hmm. So it's this. So this is bona fide. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So then what we find is that there is a relation that you can draw out of here, which says delta E is equal to minus T I zero ESI, iterated also over time. So if you imagine the following, so these boundaries are very far out, and saying that the energy that you measure here minus the energy you measure, or the energy you measure here minus the energy you measure there, is given by the flux of energy in or out of this. And if you're thinking you have a source that is sitting in the middle, the boundaries are very far out, the only thing that are going through are gravitational waves. So this would measure how much energy how much energy the system loses through gravitational waves. And it's given by what's in here. So that's the power. This amount of energy you're writing anyway.
Sorry,
yes.
Can you write down the conservation of the stress tensor? But now you're writing down the conservation of the integral of the stress tensor with respect to space.
Right.
That's not true though. The stress tensor is only conserved locally in GR.
Hold on. Part of the problem. So first, if it is conserved locally, it's conserved globally. However, the reason we're taking that integral is because of what I said. This guy is non-unique. I can shove in other things in here that would be perfectly consistent with everything we've said. So this is why this is not truly the gravitational kind of energy momentum tensor associated to a gravitational wave. However, upon iteration, much of that ambiguity goes away.
Yes, but over there, I don't see how the differential equation implies the integral equation.
So here?
Yeah, how the arrow goes down to the integral.
So this?
Start from the local equation and then obtain a global equation in space where you...
No, I'm related. So this is true everywhere. And also if I add at all points.
I'm not sure.
Well, if it is true at every single point and I add the contribution at all points, then I still have the same.
Just normally that equation comes with a nabla.
Yes.
So it's a covariant derivative, and now because of the flat whatever.
Because of to the level we're working, we can use this one or that one. Okay, maybe that's also what you're.
So that's probably related.
Okay,
right? Now because of this one, it's actually true conservation. It's not
right.
With the covariant derivative, but it's.
Well, it's either we can use one or the other one be the same to the level we're working.
Yeah, exactly.
But,
and
okay, now I understand what you're asking. But so now, if you work this out, which is a mess. And you do the integral, which also is a mess. So I'm just going to give you the answer. The answer is you find out the delta E is the integral of something we're going to call P dt, which has to do with that flux over the volume. And P will be the following. 1 over 45 sum over I and j d3 of I hat ij over t 3. Square, where I hat is the IIJ we wrote before, minus 1/3 delta IJ ILL, so the trace. So this, what enters is a trace-free quadrupole moment. You take three derivatives out of that, you square it, add all the components, that's the power of the gravitational wave. Energy is getting lost from the system in this way.
Wait, sorry, is that LL?
That's the trace of I. So it's just to say this is a quadrupole, the trace-free quadrupole. And this is related to a question that we had before. So you could do this as an exercise, come back to this problem where you have obtain the quadrupole, take the trace, work this out, and show that P will be the following. plus 2, and bring it back to g, 45, c to the 5th, m squared, l to the 4th, omega to the 6th. So that's the amount of energy that the system is losing. So you could imagine, and this goes back to a question that he was asking, ERA, he said, well, remember we took this very idealized scenario where the system was going around in circles and in orbiting, and we were just taking snapshots. We were not working out what's a back reaction. So very Kluge, and this is a technical word, people have used it, there are papers that say Kluge waveforms. Is the following. You can take these, assume that they are orbiting at some given distance. Imagine they orbit once. And then you say, I'm going to take out from that orbit the amount of energy E that is given by that expression out of one orbit. And then I can use my Newtonian understanding that if I took that energy away, I have to bring the total energy that the system has down by that little bit. So I make them a little bit closer so that the binding energy, the negative contribution, brings it down by the same amount. And then you can stitch together a whole bunch of them. And if you do that for a long while, that's a very good approximation to what the gravitational waves from this system would be, provided they're sufficiently far. Yes, or I and J, summation for I and J. So they note like all contributions coming. Let me just play around with a few things. This is at least cute. Remember, we had T Planck was what? H bar G over C to the 5th, 1/2. And we have E Planck is H bar C to the 5th, G to the 1/2. So energy per unit time is what? Luminosity, right? Or power. Yeah. So let's do that. E divided by T, E Planck divided by T Planck, EP over EP. Let's call it LP. So it's Planck luminosity. But notice something curious. So T Planck and E Planck, depending on all these three constants. But when I take this ratio, H bar goes away. It's becoming with the same power. And it leaves behind C to the 5th over G, so which is a whoppingly large number.
Power of 1/2. Eh? Power of 1/2?
No, because they are both 1/2. And then I have G, G, give me the square. C5, C5, give me the square. Good. I have one where you didn't catch me doing something when I missed a part. I'll take that one. So L, this is a number that is 10 to the whatever, 59 arcs per second. So now let me play with this. I'm going to play a little bit. Let's play a game. So what game do I want to play? So let's imagine, again, that we have these objects going around. If so, we already find out the other day that omega squared, this was m over r cubed, that's Kepler's, whatever, second law, one of the laws of Kepler that says that. So I can begin to change this. This will give me m, what is m cubed, r to the 6th. Now, let's say everything in the scale of the problem is order r. So they're very close. So this was L to the 6th. So let me use that. This M. So I have Let me just go back because I think I lost something. Was m to the l to the 4th, omega to the 6th. No, sorry, this is r to the 9. That's what I wanted. Okay. But that's what we had. So we have omega to the 6. If I replace this in here, I have that, which then I can combine this m to the 5th divided by l to the 5th. Right? So. So what I want to do now, let me just kind of group things together in a slightly different way. I'm going to put m to the 5th, l to the 5th, that m over l square times m over l cube. We also remember that v square was m over l, right? Again, using Newtonian mechanics. So I can rewrite this as v to the 6. I promise we're getting there.
Sorry, L is luminosity.
No, this is the separation.
Oh, okay.
So it's in what we use over there. The last thing we're going to do is to say this piece, let's rewrite it in a slightly different way. Let's imagine that L is a natural scale associated with the Schwarzschild radius of our system. So we know that, let's say L, this L, will be some number, let's call it A, times the Schwarzschild radius of an object that has a mass m.
Why was your velocity m over L to the half?
M over L to the half?
Because it was m to the 5th and over L to the 5th, and then you said?
So I did this.
Yeah, m over L to the half is V, apparently. Oh, because of...
I use this one. Okay. So then I can replace it to V to the 6.
Isn't this the second order? Why are we using the Newtonian limit?
We're just trying to get some rough estimate. You're going to see. So then I use this one. And for whatever L scale, the length scale in the system, let me make it in proportional to some number times the Schwarzschild radius.
Yeah. Even though L, if it was the distance... I mean, A is going to be pretty big, or?
I'm going to make it as big as I need to.
Okay.
Because this is, we're trying to get some order of magnitude estimate. This is A times 2, and I'm going to throw out this factor soon, G M over C square, right? So that we remember. So if I replace this in here, I knock off the M. Okay, that's what I want to get rid of. And I bring in a C. And again, the A, I couldn't care less. It will be whatever number it needs to be. The C will come at C to the 4th in here. And then I'll have a G square. Right? So I'm just keeping track of things. So I'm going to have a G square here. And I'm going to have a C to the 4th up. OK, this is where I wanted to get to. The other thing I can do is V, but I want to measure things V with respect to something natural. So V is a weird thing, so as a factor of the speed of light. So I can divide by C to the 6 and multiply by C to the 6. OK, now where we want.
Wasn't that a sleight of hand? Because
yes.
If you had an M over L there with that relation, you could have just said M to the 5th over L to the 5th, just replace all of it with that.
I could do, but this is, notice where, hold on. See where I'm getting to. C to the 4, C to the 6, C to the 10. I have a C to the 5 here. I have a G and a G square. OK, what did you get here? That thing. So what I was going after is to say the luminosity of gravitational waves can be rewritten as some number that knows about V over C, how rapid we're going. There's 1 over a square here, and some number, but it's a number times the Planck luminosity. And the Planck luminosity is the largest luminosity we can think in. I mean, what did we do here? A whoppingly large energy, because that was the Planck energy, a whoppingly small time scale, which was the T Planck. We divided the two, we got this ridiculously large number, and that comes in here. So this is just to say, nature, and first thing, H bar went away. So even though these concepts rely on kind of thinking in quantum terms, as far as this is concerned, it seems to be purely classic. And if we happen to have a system where V eventually gets to be very close to C, and A eventually gets to be very close to 1, seems to be that's the nature most powerful engine that we can make. And that's what black hole collisions do for us. EA goes, and of course, we went and kind of shoveled things a lot. We used Newtonian gravity a lot, but we're not that far off. I mean, whatever those numbers will do, we'll have a small correction or a correction nevertheless, but we're going to get something where the luminosity is not too far from the Planck luminosity. So even though we build these detectors of order $1 billion worth cost, because the gravitational waves, when they reach to us, are extremely weak. When they are produced, they are extremely loud. And if you were to be sitting next to these black holes that were colliding, you could feel it. But one thing you could do, if you fly, just imagine just flying close enough. So what does the gravitational wave do when it comes by us? It compresses things. It could be an astronaut sitting not too far that you're going to be fried or whatever, torn apart by tidal effects, but sufficiently close so that as a wave comes in, so your skull is much more rigid than your inner ear. So as a gravitational wave goes through, if you look in the right direction, and the polarization helps, it will just make your inner ear do this. Your skull will withstand that, but your inner ear will do that. And if it happens to be at the right frequency, and binary black holes of a few solar masses are at the right frequency, you will hear the buzz. So you will see nothing, because the gravitational waves from a black hole have nothing else than just that. But you're going to hear the sound. That's pretty cool.
That's really cool. It's like sound in a vacuum.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, you're going to be thinking that there are sound waves. And of course, there are no sound waves, but it just was your inner ear reacting the same way as you're hearing me now.
I just think this might not be very important. The L in the expression for the power, was that separation?
Yeah, was a separation, sorry. So when I wrote that there, that was a separation here. So just to say a few more things, when you look at a gravitational wave that goes like so, okay, it's coming sinusoidal from the very beginning. Just to give you kind of just a few minutes of where things are today. So one kind of dissect this kind of full wave train in a few different stages where you can do calculations by using some particular approximation. So early on is where these post-Newtonian equations are. And if you go sufficiently early, you can do the trick that I mentioned. You can just do it on average, every kind of orbit, reduce the energy by that amount. And early on, that's a pretty good approximation. Of course, as the velocity gets higher and the orbit gets tighter, that begins to be not good enough, and you have to keep adding post and post and post Newtonian. And then at some point, they fail. Then there is a merger where everything is very complicated. There is no approximations that you can make. You have to solve these equations in full, which is complicated. But then after that, there is a black hole that you have formed. Let's say if you're colliding black holes, that's the simplest case. It's a case in vacuum. We don't have to worry about anything else. Then this, you have an exponentially an oscillating behavior to quiescence. And these are things that are related to some terminology called quasi-normal modes. Which are pretty neat. And in the case of general relativity, you can measure many modes. For if you change the kind of the angular momentum number and the azimuthal number, so if you're describing this piece, say in terms of YLMs, you find out the different LMs have different decay rates and different oscillatory frequencies. But all of them are related. So if you measure one quasi-normal mode, you extract out of that the mass and spin of the black hole that you just formed, and you determine what every other quasi-normal mode should be in general relativity. So measuring two gives you a heck of a test of general relativity. Because if you don't get it right, then it's already saying there is something else that is amiss. What else do you want to say? But that comes in the realm of black hole perturbation theory, where you don't follow this route, where you assume the metric is flat and there is a little bit of a perturbation. There you say the metric is the metric of Kerr, and there are small perturbations on top of that, and then you plug that back into Einstein's equations and see what equations of motion you have, and you have, if you massage them enough, then you get to something that's quite nicely tractable.
Janus?
Yes.
How stringent, exactly how successfully the GR passes the LIGO test?
So exactly. So great. So nowadays, LIGO is testing generativity. Something, so let's say, it depends what we want to test. So to broad level, generativity is very good to a few percent. However, there are other things, like the one detection of gravitational waves is related to what he was asking, with near coincidence with a gamma ray burst, allow people to also constrain the mass of a graviton to a ridiculously low number, 10 to the minus 22 electron volts per c squared or something like that. And that was one measurement. So people have been bounding the mass of the photon for a very, very long time. One measure of gravitational waves beat the bound on the photon. So now we know the graviton is less massive than the photon. That's pretty cool. And that was just one measurement.
Is the precision level of the test something comparable to what they got CERN, or even more?
Of the photon? No, so the...
Of the general, just the general LIGO experiment. Are they sensitivity? Or?
But what are you comparing?
Just like, given some observable to how many decimal places, for example, you can do.
Well, again, so one observable with the mass of the graviton, then it's much better. If you're saying the observable is... the mass of the final black hole when two initial masses, it's not as good. It's good to a few percent. How well are you determining the final spin of the object or individual spins of black hole? That's still, I mean, in some cases reasonable, but within a few percent. In other cases, the error is huge. Distance to systems, sometimes the error is like they tell you 700 megaparsecs plus minus 500 megaparsecs. So it's very, very broad. So there are some things that you can nail quite well, and some other things that you still need much better detectors. This is why these detectors that I mentioned here are kind of the first round of detectors that can get gravitational waves. Again, just to put in comparison, when did we have the first particle physics detection? I don't know, the electron, whatever that. This is the first detection of a gravitational wave was 2015. The first kind of indirect detection of gravitational wave was 1993, whatever they call it, pulse binary Taylor. So this is a very new field. And there are several, so this detector that comes next, there is the people using pulsars. So pulsars, if you know, if you've heard about pulsar timing arrays, so we detect pulsars for a long time. Pulsars come at very, very precise intervals. And if at some point that interval gets longer or shorter, well, maybe because the gravitational wave went through. So people are using pulsars, following pulsars for a very long time to try and get detections. And then the promise is in a few years, we'll get to hear something interesting from them. So, and then there are third generation detectors that are much more sensitive than these that should be in construction in the 2030s. And there is a lot. We just turned this on. What else I want to say? I think I'm on. Oh, the
wavefront is equivalent to having the S, right?
Say again?
The wavefront that you get from, like.
Yeah, it's essentially getting those, well, not the S, it's the H's. But yeah, then you translate it into the S's because that's what the detectors measure. Oh, the last thing I want to say, so just take one detector. Let me finish this thought. And just to put it also in comparison, when these two, let's take the very first collision. All of them. By now, about 100 collisions of binary black holes have been detected, and a few, one for sure, maybe a few more, of binary neutron stars, or at least one object was a neutron star. If you compare, if you ask how much energy was irradiated, was it radiated during the collision, and it's a few percent of the total mass, 5% of the total mass. So you have went into gravitational waves, and then we know that going into gravitational waves means energy. So a few percent of the mass that you put in of your budget, it gets translated into energy. Compared to nuclear reaction, that's about 0.1% or 0.01%. So this is at least a couple of order of magnitude more efficient in converting mass into energy.
I just wanted to ask, how do you measure the distance to the source having the wavefront?
Good. So what do people do in gravitational wave detectors? First, you construct a whole bunch of gravitational waves for all possible masses. You don't know when the gravitational wave comes in, so you don't know the masses, you don't know any of the intrinsic, there are 15 or 17 parameters that you need to take into account. You don't know which ones are the ones describing your waveform. You vary all of them and you try to find the best match. As part of that, you also have the strength that is decaying as 1 over r. And then that's how you extract it. You also match that. However, something to that point is that if you go sufficiently far, I can multiply the mass by 1 plus z, the r by 1 plus z, and now I have cosmological redshift unknown. And so then that is a complication. So if you're seeing sufficiently far out, then you either have to assume a cosmology to turn a redshift distance into distance, or you need to find a way to break it out.
I thought I always heard that gravitational wave events, we can use them to uniquely measure distance without needing to know the redshift or anything about cosmology.
No, that's not true. So it's undetermined to the cosmology. However, and that's related to an earlier question, if you happen to have an electromagnetic event that went with it, then you can use the redshift that you see and then just get it uniquely. So that's what people say is like, if you have a bright siren, so it's a gravitational wave that came with that, you can do something that is free of many of the systematics of the standard measurement. But you can just see from there, if I multiply m by a number and r by the same number, I will not change anything. So that's a problem. I mean, it's a problem, it's a feature. It is what it is.
I have a question about the conservation of the stress energy tensor, because stress energy tensor does not contain any gravitational part. So like when your system radiates energy through gravitational waves, the stress energy tensor is not conserved.
So, okay, good thing. All right, one of the things that you do is you go far out, very close to infinity, so you have the only thing that can get there is energy through gravitational waves. Matter doesn't get there. So you can make sense of these global kind of quantities or these far out things. Locally, you don't know.
Why do we have the conservation of stress energy tensor?
So here what it was saying is at the level we're working, we can make this approximation. And there are some fully determined, defined things. So there is some ambiguity that you only get rid of it if you're going sufficiently far out, and then you do the intro. In our assumption, we were in vacuum. There was nothing else. The only we kind of motivated an effective stress energy tensor associated to the gravitational waves. That's what we did.
So that covariant, divergence of the stress energy equal to zero.
It's only of this T. We're imagining they're in vacuum. The source was somewhere there. And we're seeing
it's only in mass space.
So let's say two things. So one, for the gravitational waves only works and to the level that it works. Remember, this is not 100% rigorous. To the level that it works, only works in this approximation that we made. In general, now if you think of you have a truly a bona fide, well-defined stress energy tensor, TAB, this is true. This will always be true. So this has to be conserved. But remember, what is conserved here is not rho. It's T00, if you want. And T00 has rho, but also has the curvature of the space-time, has things built in here that...
I thought the stress energy tensor in the Einstein equation does not contain any information about the... Like, it doesn't itself contain any curvature.
It does, because it, at the very least, and this is related to his question, you have to think of the covariant derivative. Yeah. And if you then expand this out, there is this, the determinant of the metric shows up, and that's how you come in. But also, even the T00 is not something you say, oh, this is the energy. I mean, this is not energy density. It's not my rho. It's something else. Okay, let's stop here.